So I think we finished verse 33. Is that right?
Yes.
Or not? We finished 33? Okay. So verse 34. When my imagination rises as veils and possessor spirits, it is the weapon of evil karma returning on me for accumulating negative karma against divinities and their mantras. From now on, I shall vanquish all negative conceptions. Okay, so the situation is when my imagination rises as veils and possessor spirits. Okay, so this is taught within the context of cultures where, you know, veils here means, you know, demon spirits or possessor spirits where beliefs in them are very strong. Our culture is a little bit different, but still sometimes there can be interference from other beings who are like people. People interfere. Spirits can interfere also. But what's important in this sentence, when my imagination arises as veils and possessor spirits, is this word imagination. The Tibetan is namtok. Okay, and it's helpful to remember that Tibetan namtok, because it comes in a lot of different situations and it's translated in different ways. Here it's translated as imagination, but namtok also, Lama Yeshe used to translate it as superstition. Not like, you know, thinking if you step on a crack you break your mother's back, you know, not that kind of stuff. But superstition meaning wrong views and all sorts of misconceptions. Or it can also be translated as preconceptions, where we have all sorts of thoughts. And this is where our mind does its creative writing class. Okay? When our mind is just a superstition factory or a preconception factory. You know, one incorrect thought after another, dreaming up, imagining all sorts of situations. Okay? So our mind kind of works overtime here. And we can see it in our own lives. There's various levels of misconceptions. I mean, of course, there's the deeper one, seeing impermanent things as permanent, impure things as pure, things that are in the nature of suffering as happiness, and things without a self as having a self. Those are really deep levels of superstitious or preconceptual consciousnesses. But then there's other ones, like, you know how sometimes we go into this state of mind of like, oh, nobody likes me. You know, here I am and I'm with my friends who I'm usually with who like me, but now I just know nobody likes me and I just don't fit in and I feel so uncomfortable. You know, has your mind ever gotten in that kind of state? You know, just kind of, you know, the mind just starts thinking all these things. Or, you know, everything's kind of going on, you know, regular in your life, but then all of a sudden you go, oh, I know I'm not going to be able to afford everything. Everything, you know, I'm just going to have so many financial problems, and what am I going to do? And then worry, you know? And so, you know, this expression namtok is when our mind just kind of trips out on all sorts of inaccurate thoughts that we believe in at that very moment. Okay? So we do this quite a bit, yeah? And this is the beauty of the Dharma, is that it points out to us our incorrect ways of thinking. Okay, so sometimes our imagination, our preconceptions, if you're living in a culture that believes in spirits, then everything arises as a spirit, you know. I mean, in cultures that believe in spirits, then when you're unhappy, it, you know, you attribute it to a spirit. Or when things are going wrong, you attribute it to a spirit. And I think it's very nice that it says here, you know, when our imagination, our preconception, you know, arises as demons and possessor spirits. Because it is, you know, those kinds of things are, quote, invoked by all of our opinion factory and our preconception factory. And there's a nice little story about Milarepa when he was, you know, meditating in his cave. And one day there were all these spirits bothering him. And he said, why are you guys here bothering me? And one of them said, well, why did all your Namtok ask us to come here? Yeah. So, or why did your Namtok create us? You know, in other words, that these spirits were just creations of his own mind that was working overtime, the same way as we can talk ourselves into thinking that, you know, none of the people who usually like us, and everything we're doing doesn't work, you know, isn't going to be successful, and, you know, or you could start getting worried, oh, I'm sure I have, you know, terminal illness, you know, you haven't even been to the doctor or anything, but, you know, I'm sure that this is a very serious illness and I'm never going to recover, and, you know, just all these tumbling of thoughts that we get into. Okay? So, it arises as all these different superstitions. So, it can also mean like falling unconscious or getting crippled or strokes, or sometimes, you know, there are spirit afflictions. And it's always hard to tell when there's a spirit affliction and when it's something else, because, you know, like in Tibetan culture, what we would describe as mental problems, they describe as spirit harms. And then, like, I remember one of my friends was, she was doing some doctoral research in Dharamsala, and there was a young Tibetan girl who was translating for her. And the Tibetan girl wanted to marry, you know, one young man she had met in school, but her parents didn't want her to marry him. They wanted her to marry somebody else who was more successful. And all of a sudden, she got so sick, you know, what in our terms would have been a nervous breakdown. You know, it was like anybody in Western culture would have said she had a nervous breakdown. In Tibetan culture, you know, they took her to a lama and had him do, you know, practices to exercise the spirit. Because that's how they frame what's happening. So it's very interesting, you know, just different conceptual frameworks for what's happening. His Holiness Dalai Lama teases the Tibetans a lot and tells them that they that they're always attributing all sorts of things to spirits that aren't due to spirits, you know. And in some way you can see how our mind is always projecting stuff outward, so we embody our own confusion by making it another being who's harming us. But the point is not whether there are really spirits or not really spirits. The point here is that it's our Namtok, our preconception opinion factory, superstition factory, that is making all the trouble, okay, and causing all these different things. So when that happens, yeah, when your mind's just really difficult to work with, to remember this is the weapon of evil karma returning on me, and what did we do in the past? For accumulating negative karma against divinities and their mantras. Okay, so what this means is that in the past, we, you know, previous lives, we may have taken initiations and then not kept our vows and our commitments. Or we have, may have made a pledge to, let's say, do the succession guru yoga, but we don't do it. So we don't keep our promises to the divinities, properly. You know, when we've taken initiations or whatever. Okay, so then this comes back as, you know, our mind kind of going, you know, out of control in this negative way. And so from now on, what do we do to remedy it? Is from now on I shall vanquish all negative conceptions. So here again, negative conceptions means Namtok. So it can be, you know, those, you know, all the bubbly ones where our mind's thinking all sorts of strange thoughts, and it can also mean those four, you know, distorted conceptions to vanquish all of them. And what, so it can, you know, on one hand, it can mean non-dharma thoughts, you know, the mind just kind of tripping out on different things, and it can also mean those four distorted conceptions, and then it also can mean, what in Tantra is called ordinary appearance and ordinary grasping. In other words, things appearing to us as ordinary, things appearing to us as truly existent, and then from our mind assenting to that appearance and grasping at things as being ordinary, grasping at things as being truly existent. So in Tantra practice, this is opposed by a practice called clear appearance and divine identity. In other words, through clear or divine appearance, we see other beings as deities and the environment as the mandala. Okay, so we see it in a pure way, and then by pure appearance, that means not holding these things, or I'm sorry, by divine identity, it means holding the dignity of being the deity and the, you know, one's comrades being the other deities, one's environment being the mandala, the things that you use in your environment as being pure objects of use, all the offerings. And then also holding these things as being empty of inherent existence and yet dependently arising. Okay? So abandoning ordinary appearance and ordinary grasping through cultivating clear appearance and divine identity. Okay? So that's what we do as a way to oppose it. And we can see even, you know, how that works right away. You know, that let's say our mind is getting in this thing about, oh, I know all my friends don't like me. Yeah, you know, I just know it. You know, they just don't like me. I don't fit in. They're all talking about me behind my back. You know, or sometimes we do it with one particular friend. We focus everything on them and, you know, go on this trip. Okay, so our mind's tripping out. Then how do you use clear appearance and divine identity to counteract that? Well, you see yourself as a deity. You see the other person as a deity. You see the words they're speaking as mantra. And especially if you see yourself as a deity, well, you know, let's say you're practicing Chenrezig. Chenrezig's not going to go in some big trip about, you know, oh, all my friends don't like me. I know it. You know, Tara doesn't like me anymore. Manjushri doesn't want to speak to me anymore. Even Vajrapani's talking behind my back. You know, if you hold some kind of, you know, divine identity oneself, then you're not going to, you know, there's no solid me who, you know, is going to think that way, because clearly deities don't think in that way. And if you're thinking about your friends, you know, as being deities, then also certainly they're not going to think that way about you either. So it completely pulls our mind out of that habitual, self-centered, neurotic, you know, way of viewing everything in the way in which our mind gets sometimes, where everything looks like it's against us and everybody looks like an enemy. And we all get that way sometimes. Yeah? Okay. So then verse 35. When I am lost and wander about like a powerless person, it is the weapon of evil karma returning on me for driving others such as my guru from their abodes. From now on, I shall expel no one from their home. Okay, so the situation, when I am lost and wander about like a powerless person. Okay, so this is a person who's helpless, who's somebody who has no freedom. You don't have freedom to leave the situation that you're in. You don't have freedom to go to a better situation. Or you have too much freedom and you're just wandering around totally lost, not knowing what to do. You're exiled from your home. You wander about and travel in strange places, but not for any particular reason, simply because you're lost and confused. Or if you're a refugee and you've been forced to leave your homeland. I remember when Geshe Nawandargi taught this, you know, he was saying, oh, this line, you know, talks about me and, you know, the other Tibetans who became refugees. So to remember at that time that this is the weapon of evil karma returning upon us. And what did we do in past lives, or even in this life, we don't know, for driving others, such as our gurus, from their abodes. Okay, so it can mean our spiritual teacher, it can mean our parents, or our friends, or animals. So driving them from their abodes, making them move, making them get out of places because we're annoyed with them, we don't want to be near them. okay, like evicting somebody from an apartment because you just don't like them and don't want to be around them, or forcing somebody to leave, okay, like this mean thing I told you about in sixth grade that I did to Rosie Knox. Yeah, so that would fit in there. I'm waiting for Rosie Knox to show up at a teaching sometime and say, oh, I remember that. okay. It can also, our parents, friends, even animals, evicting them, making them homeless, making people move and live where they don't really want to, where they don't fit in. You know, we, in a previous life, we could have been occupying forces that evict people from their homes, or made people into refugees, or, we could have been police that have walked in and, under the jurisdiction of the law, stolen others' possessions or evict them from their homes, calling them terrorists, things that are going on in the Gaza. Okay, so these kinds of actions, then it brings about the result of having to wander about like a refugee, a powerless person oneself. And so the antidote from that is, from now on, I shall expel no one from their home. Okay, so to wish other, in other words, it also means to wish others to be peaceful and happy and to be able to live in a safe place and to be able to live peacefully without having all this confusion in where they live. I've had some interesting experiences as a nun, being homeless and, not having a home, not having support, just kind of being there in space, And it's been quite a growing experience, not one I would necessarily wish on other people, but, it arose from this kind of karma similarly. Okay, we have some misnumberings, because it looks like there's two verse 35s. So this next one should be 36. Okay. Looks like there's quite several misnumberings here. Anyway, verse 36. When calamities such as frost and hailstorms occur, it is the weapon of evil karma returning on me for failing to observe properly my pledges and moral precepts. From now on, I shall maintain my pledges and so on purely. Okay, so the situation when calamities such as frost and hailstorms occur. Yeah, so frost, kills your crops. Hailstorms destroy the crops. When I lived in Missouri, I remember taking a walk one day, and there were hailstorms that were the size of marbles coming down. And they were really hard, and, I could begin to get a feeling of how they could destroy the crops and really leave people, quite up in the air, especially, if you don't have a reserve of food. So it's a situation where your crops are destroyed, where the cattle die, where there's, all these kind of turmoils caused by, bad weather or disease. So this is an environmental result. When we talk about the four results of karma, or sometimes it's the three results of karma, but one of them is divided into, there's the maturation result, there's the result that corresponds with the cause, and then there's the environmental result. The maturation result is what realm we're born into. One of the six realms of hell being hungry ghosts, animals, humans, demigods, or gods. And then the result that corresponds with the cause, can be or it's the corresponding result. I changed my translation of this, and I can't remember the new one now. But one of them, there's two kinds of these corresponding results. One is that corresponds with the cause. In other words, you have the tendency to do the same negative action again and again. Like gossiping, we do it again and again. Or you see people who have the same kind of relationship problems again and again, no matter who they're with. Okay, and then the other kind of corresponding result is the result that corresponds in terms of our experience. In other words, what we made somebody else experience, now we experience. So, for example, in the case of lying, the result that corresponds to the corresponding result in terms of the cause would be the tendency to lie again and again, and the corresponding result in terms of our experience would be other people lying to us, or other people not trusting our word, or you know, that having a lot of trust issues with other people. Okay, and then the last result is the environmental result. So that's the environment that we're born into. Yeah. So here, you know, being born and having things happen in the environment, like hailstones or frost, or maybe here it would be a drought, even. You know, our kind of climate is more susceptible to a drought, or maybe, you know, a super heavy winter where, you know, it's just, you know, very difficult. Okay, but something like that, that's all kind of the environmental result. So what brought about, you know, different kind of calamities? It could also include floods or fires. Failing to observe properly my pledges and moral precepts. Okay, so if we've taken the five precepts, then, you know, not taking them seriously, transgressing them and not confessing. Same thing with monastic precepts. Same thing with bodhisattva precepts, not really making an effort to try and keep them. Or some people take them and don't even know what they are, so they don't know what to practice and what to abandon. Or taking tantric vows and commitments. And then, you know, not doing the practice that one promised to do, or not keeping the other tantric vows and commitments. So you can see that how this action of not properly keeping vows and moral precepts results in calamities such as frost and hailstorms and things that destroy your crops, because it's like what's happening internally, happening externally. Because when we don't keep our pledges and our moral precepts, we destroy our own, you know, the crops of spiritual realization. Okay? You know, if realizations had started to grow in our mind, if we don't keep our vows and commitments, we completely destroy them. Like hailstones falling on top of a crop and destroying it. Or like frost just freezing it. And, you know, making the flowers or the fruit die. So it's just kind of a physical manifestation of an internal process. We can see that there. So how to remedy it? From now on, I shall maintain my pledges and so on purely. Okay? So having seen the faults of not keeping our various precepts and vows and commitments well, then making a determination to keep them well. Okay, so here is why I always recommend to people to go very slowly in terms of taking precepts and vows and taking initiations and all these kinds of things. Because if you rush in, then you wind up taking a lot of things and you get confused afterwards because your mind's not really clear about what, you know, why you did that. And then all these things just seem as big burdens and you don't understand what to practice and what to abandon. Whereas if people really go slowly and think about the precepts very carefully, then when they take them, the precepts are real blessings and real protection. And so this is one reason that before people take refuge, I have you do a refuge, you know, group. Because you study the five precepts, you discuss them, you make examples from your life, you know, you study the different guidelines for how to keep the refuge. Those are in the blue prayer book. And you think about, well, which ones are easy to keep, which ones are difficult to keep, what are circumstances in which I might break them, what kind of habits can I cultivate in my mind to help, you know, help me be able to follow these guidelines and keep my precepts. Okay, so you think about all those things beforehand, and then you become clearer, and then when you take the precepts, your mind's very happy, and, you know, you understand why you took them and what you want to do, and you really want to do that. Yeah, so you're not rushing into things. And so that's likewise why, you know, you know, when people go to Kalachakra and they're new, and I say, you know, just hold on, don't rush in and take a lot of things, because then you just get confused afterwards. Much, much better, go slowly, you know. And His Holiness always recommends that for highest class Tantra initiations. He wants people to have been a Buddhist for 5 years beforehand, so that, you know, they go in when it feels comfortable, and they're not just doing it in a big rush or because, you know, everybody else is telling them they should and there's a lot of peer pressure or whatever. Okay? And so again, in all these verses, what we wanted to do is do the taking and giving meditation. So for example, in this one, we would take on the feelings of people who lived in environments where there were calamities and floods and fires and crop destruction, and think of their suffering and take on that suffering. And when we take on other suffering, it's very important to remember that we don't just take it on and then it sits inside of us. Yeah, because that's absolutely no good to anybody. So it's very important to remember when we take it on that it becomes a thunderbolt, and then it hits at our own namtok, at our heart, you know, our own self-centeredness, all of our preconceptions, all of our afflictions and our ignorance, and that thunderbolt hits at that and destroys that. So then our heart is very open and free and very joyful. Okay, and we contemplate emptiness, and then within that space of emptiness, then the light appears, and we imagine, you know, multiplying and giving away our body, our possessions, and our positive potential, so that it brings happiness to others and gives them all the positive, circumstances to be able to practice the Dharma, and even gives them the realizations. So that's very important, you know, when we're doing the taking and giving meditation. You don't just sit there and take on everybody's negativities and then feel like you're all just, that all you are is a pile of negativities. That's not doing the meditation properly. Okay? So, you know, we have to make really sure that we do the meditation properly. And we remember that taking on the suffering has destroyed all of our afflicted mental states and all of our superstitious and preconceptual thoughts. Yeah, so that our own mind is pure. Okay, now the number is getting screwed up. It's going to be verse 36, I guess. We should go through all these numbers again. Oh, right, okay, so it is, okay, there's just 235. Okay, so 37. Okay, when I remain greedy but bereft of material wealth, it is the weapon of evil karma returning on me for failing to give charity and making offerings to the triple gem. From now on, I shall strive in the acts of giving and offering. Okay, so the situation when I remain greedy but bereft of material wealth. So we're poor but full of greed and wanting more and better. Okay? So that's the situation. We have a lot of ambition for wealth, for position, for possessions, for worldly status, but we feel like we're totally poor in terms of all these worldly things. But the mind is, you know, craving, I want, I need. You know how the mind can get sometimes. I want somebody to recognize me. I want to be known in the magazines. I want to be, you know, published. I want to be, my music distributed. I want, my card, everybody to have my card. Or, you know, I want to have nice, a nice vacation house. Or I want more money. Or I want new computer stuff. I want the latest digital this, that, and the other thing. You know, whatever it is, you know, our mind's just greedy, but we can't afford any of it. Or it just doesn't work out for us to get any of it. So I think we've probably all been in that state at some time or another. Yeah, greedy mind, but no possibility of getting what we want. So to remember that this is the weapon of evil karma returning on me. So rather than blame other people and say it's unfair and accuse others and make a big ruckus, to realize that this is just the ripening of our own karma. In other words, actions that we did in the past, And in previous lives, you know, under the influence of ignorance and self-centeredness, it's all just ripening on us now. So no sense getting bent out of shape and angry at people. So what did we do that brought this about on ourselves is we failed to give charity and to make offerings to the three jewels. Okay? So giving charity means giving to what's called the field of compassion. Yeah? So those are objects. It's called objects of compassion. It means sentient beings of compassion. So those who are sick, who are poor, who are needy, who can't take care of themselves, you know, somebody who's having difficulty, who's, you know, mentally depressed or physically incapacitated or impoverished. Okay, so the field of compassion, other sentient beings, we fail to give to them and to help them out when they've been in need. So we failed in that way, and we've also failed to make offerings to the three jewels. The three jewels is called the field of merit, or the field of positive potential, or sometimes the field of good qualities. So we make offerings to the three jewels because they're endowed with so many good qualities, like the verses of praise that we say before, you know, before our meals to the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, remembering their qualities. So those make them very powerful objects of making offerings. So in the past, we haven't made offerings. You know, our mind has said, well, if I give it, then I won't have it. You know, so we do this whether there's the opportunity to give to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or whether there's the opportunity to give to people who are ill or incapacitated or upset. You know, oh, if I give it, then I won't have it. Or, you know, these people don't really deserve it. You know, those people are poor because they don't work hard. Yeah, so I'm not going to give them anything to help them because they just need to work hard, you know. And the three jewels, well, they're just bilking the people, you know, trying to get their money so that they can build big expensive statues and temples and, you know, like the Catholic Church, so we don't, criticizing religious institutions, being a Catholic or, you know, Buddhist, and attributing negative motivations and then using that as a justification for not making offerings. Okay? So these are the kinds of things that we've done in the past life. So this kind of miserliness, basically miserliness, yeah, and attachment to our possessions, it also causes rebirth in the hungry ghost realm. Yeah, because the hungry ghosts, they don't have enough to eat, they don't have enough to drink. It's kind of like, you know, we look at it as a being who's, you know, very thirsty and very hungry. But you can look at it, you know, how some people never have enough love and they're always going around looking for love, kind of like, you know, a love addict or a pleasure addict or whatever it is. So that's kind of like the same mind of a hungry ghost, never feeling like one has enough. Going from relationship to relationship, never feeling satisfied. Okay, that kind of thing. If you can't relate to the hungry ghost realm, this is another way to relate it. And if you've never experienced severe hunger and thirst because you happen to have the good karma to, you know, always have enough to eat and drink, then think of it in a mental level of the mind that is impoverished and, you know, very needy. Okay, so it's from failing to give, you know, from being stingy. So the remedy is, from now on, I shall strive in the acts of giving and offering. So here giving means particularly giving to the field of compassion, people who are poor and sick and, you know, so on. And offering refers offering to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, so it's important not to hoard our possessions and then claim that we can't make offerings. Yeah. So, you know, we hoard our money, we hoard our possessions, and then, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have enough to give, you know. And it's not just saying it to others that we don't have enough to give. In our own mind, we think, I don't have enough to give. But if we looked at our situation, actually, there's plenty of stuff that we have that we've been hoarding. Okay? And when we make charity, we should give things that are useful. We should give things that are good quality and not just give something that's broken, you know, or useless. So, you know, it doesn't mean that you need to go out and buy something new and give something new to the Goodwill. Okay, I mean, we have things that we've used that are still in good condition, you know, and we can give them to charities and other people can reuse them, you know. And it felt really good when we gave our big freezer away. Yeah, and, you know, we had an extra blender. And I think it's important for the Abbey as an organization to give, in the same way I think it's important for Dharma centers or, you know, any kind of organization as a group of people to be generous. And then actually as individuals also we need to be generous. Okay, so we can give away things that we've used before, that, you know, we give them with a mind that, you know, thinks of the benefit others are going to get from it, not just because, you know, well, let's get rid of it and, you know, they'll come pick it up so it saves me a trip to driving them somewhere. Yeah, okay, but to do it with a good motivation and with an attitude of kindness. And similarly, when we make offerings, like, you know, when we offer to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, on the altar, when you offer to a temple or a monastery or an abbey or a Dharma center, to offer things that are of good quality. You know, it's not like we go out and we buy fruit and then we pick through it and the things that are bruised we offer to the Buddha and we keep all the nice fruit for ourselves. Okay, it should be just the opposite, that we give the nice things away and we eat the things that, you know, are bruised. And I had a very interesting experience regarding this. This verse has always spoke very strongly to me. This one, you know, my hepatitis story about verse 10, and then this verse 37, I had a very strong experience. I think I may have mentioned when I first went to live in the monastery in France, you know, there was no support for the monastery. The Dharma Center gave us the horse stables to live in, but then we all had to pay to live at the monastery. And we had to pay for our food and clothing and also for heat. And the buildings were insulated because it was the horse stable. And it was really, really cold. And it was, I didn't have any money. You know, I had gotten back from India and, you know, whatever money I had saved and people had given me was all used up. And so the first winter there in France, I didn't have any money to pay for heat. And I was so cold, you know, because even though it was in southern France, it wasn't in the north where, you know, it gets really, really cold. It was still definitely cold enough. So I did a lot of prostrations that winter to keep warm. Wasn't necessarily the greatest motivation for prostration, but I tried to transform my mind and do them with a good motivation. But I remember so clearly one day sitting in our meditation hall and having a talk with myself. You know how you sometimes have talks with yourself? So I was having a talk with myself about and thinking of this verse and saying, you know, children, you're so poor. Because that was the winter I couldn't... Lama Yeshe was giving teachings in Italy, and I couldn't go because I didn't have enough money to pay for they were charging the Sangha to stay there, and I didn't have enough money to pay for that or for the train fare. The previous year, somebody had given me money to do that, and I was able to go, but then the following year, I didn't have enough. And then also, I was so cold, so I was sitting there going, okay, children, you know, you have this problem, and here it is. The reason is because you're stingy. You know, and I started recalling like so many times when I've been stingy, and I sometimes just, you know, horribly stingy, like traveling with other people. I remember traveling in Europe in Europe with other people, and we would get something and then divide it, you know, three ways. And I would, even when it came to, you know, rounding off the pennies, I would always round it off in my favor, yeah? So I either had to give somebody less or they had to give me more. I mean, just stinginess over pennies when you're dividing things. And, you know, I mean, that's really stingy. Or, like I say, when I lived in India, not being able to to give 25 pace to a leper for a cup of tea, you know, because my own mind felt so impoverished. And so just looking, you know, I spent a great deal of time just kind of looking over how I got my mind into this impoverished state, and then as a result, you know, found it very difficult to make offerings and to give, and, you know, was constantly battling with my own miserliness and saying, well, look, you know, this is a karmic result of what you've been doing. And, you know, it may have been the karmic result of things I did in previous lives, but whatever it was, I had certainly done it in this life too. And so I just had this long talk with myself and said, okay, you have to start changing, you know, and you have to start being more generous, and you have to start being, you know, giving, and not just, you know, kind of visualizing giving, but actually doing it. And so, you know, I think I've told you my cashmere sweater story. So you've heard that? Yeah, yeah. So, you know, having to sometimes really push myself to give things away. But it's very interesting because I found that as I started doing this and getting myself more in the habit of being generous, all of a sudden I started having more things. You know? It was so amazing. You know, it's not like it happened the next day, but within the next few years, you know, by the time I left, I was able to pay for heat. I mean, I don't remember being really cold, but the last winter I was there. Yeah. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, something shifted there. Yeah. So, I really think, and you can also see just in a very regular way that when we're generous people, then people help us out. You know? I mean, it just kind of, it comes back on us. You know? Whereas when somebody is very stingy, then nobody wants to help them out afterwards. And it's kind of, it was reminding me when Doug was talking this last weekend. Remember when he was saying about how when he lived in Canada, if he asked other people for help, like all his neighbors would help, or even if he didn't ask, if he was out working on something on the street, the neighbors would probably come out and help. But, you know, here he was living in Seattle, and, you know, even he asked somebody to help him, they put it off and put it off until finally he had to do it himself. But you can see just by Doug's, you know, he was, you know, that if that one, you know, those neighbors then asked him for help, I mean, he was like losing his interest in helping those people because they hadn't helped him. And I was kind of trying to encourage, you know, don't give up on them and, you know, don't become like them just because they did like that to you. Yeah. But still to you know, you can see just even in this life, somebody who doesn't help other people when they need help, then, you know, nobody's going to be there for them. Okay, so this life, it works, you know, when we consider our deeds in previous lives, too. Okay, so to make a resolution, from now on I shall strive in acts of giving and offering. And so, you know, it's especially important when we're giving, you know, to the field of compassion or making offerings to the field of qualities, that we do so with a good motivation, that we're not just doing karmic business. I mean, sometimes, you know, people hear a teaching like this and they say, oh, well, I'll be generous because then I'll get rich. You know, I'll be rich in a future life. And you find in some Asian countries people do this, you know, the idea of giving so that in a future life they'll be rich. And that is a Dharma motivation because it is renouncing, you know, the attachment to the happiness of this life. So it is a good motivation, you know, and it is the beginning motivation that we have in being generous, okay? But it's good not to just get stuck there, but to go beyond that and to think, well, I want to give, you know, so that this positive potential can ripen in liberation, so that it can ripen in full enlightenment, okay? And not just leave it with, so that I'll have enough wherewithal and a good environment and enough possessions in future lives. What I find interesting is in America, when people look at Asians who are who make offerings with the attitude of, you know, I'll create merit so I'll be rich in a future life, Americans will, or Westerners will look at these people and say, oh, it's such a selfish motivation. They're just doing it so they'll be rich in future lives. You know, what a bad motivation. You should give just because you feel it's good to give. But then those very same people who criticize, they don't give. Because, well, I need to make my car payments. Yeah? And, you know, I want to go to the movies and my kids need to get some new Nike shoes and they need to go to summer camp. And, you know, my family vacation costs a lot and we're remodeling the house. And, you know, and so these very same people who are spending money that, you know, in a luxurious way, because I grew up in India where this, when you spend money like on these kinds of things, it, I mean, in my mind, it's luxurious because it's, you know, okay, you don't remodel your kitchen, you can get by. Yeah, or your kid doesn't get Nike shoes, they get regular shoes. Yeah, and so it's possible to trim back on some of these things. But for some people's minds, they don't have, like, the experience I had or whatever. Then, you know, they feel like they really need these things. And then, of course, they don't have money to give to other people or to the three jewels because then they can't keep up, you know, their middle-class lifestyle or upper-middle-class lifestyle. You know, but meanwhile, criticizing Asians for having a self-centered motivation because the Asians are giving because they want to be rich in a future life. Okay, so I think you know we shouldn't be like that. Yeah, and actually, I find when I'm in Asia, you know, people have that they really believe in karma. And so they believe, you know, even if some of them, and not all of them are doing it for future lives, some are doing for liberation, some for enlightenment, but they're doing it because they really, really believe in karma. Whereas often, so many of us in the West, we talk like we believe in karma, but then when it comes to creating the karma that's going to bring about wealth, you know, we don't want to use our money that way, we want to use our money on ourselves and our own enjoyment. So we talk about karma, but we don't. It's hard to live as if we actually believe that karma exists. Okay, so it's important when we're giving that, you know, we give with a good motivation, not looking for prestige or recognition or to compete with other people. You know, I'm going to give more than somebody else, so therefore I'm going to get more perks than somebody else. Or especially if you give in to a temple or to a Dharma teacher, not thinking, oh, well, I gave a whole lot of money, so now they have to pay more attention to me, or, you know, now they have to do this and that for me. Because we can have a lot of expectations sometimes when we give, and then it just, it contaminates our giving. So to really try and give just with a totally, free heart and with a mind that really takes delight in giving. You know, not like it's a torture or paying a tax or, you know, I have to do it so that I don't look like I'm so cheap. But really with a mind that takes delight. And that's the mind that I see sometimes when I'm in Asia with people really being so happy to give, you know. And I see it here in the West too. Sometimes, you know, people just feeling so happy to give, and then it's just a delight, yeah. So here we're mostly talking about giving material things, but then there's also giving of our time and giving service, you know, helping people out when they need help instead of saying, sorry, I'm too busy, I can't do it, you know, but really being generous with our time, being generous with our energy, being generous with the Dharma when people want to hear the Dharma or they have questions or whatever, you know, giving them the Dharma, giving them Dharma books. So, you know, in many ways I see the Abbey as a place where, you know, why I'm always saying it's Dharma centers and monasteries and temples are a place where you come to give, not where you not a place where you come to get, because you train your mind in giving and you take delight in giving, and that is receiving yourself, because you receive a happy mind in return. And so that's what I think is so neat in watching, like, our work parties here at the Abbey, is people come and they work so hard, and sometimes, you know, much more than an 8-hour day, but they're so happy, you know, and they feel so good when they leave the Abbey. And you know, and so you can just see people creating so much good karma by their goodwill in coming to offer service. Or sometimes people, well, you, in fact, you know, you wrote that it's fun to give. And so people having that kind of attitude of, you know, oh, it's fun and it's, happy to contribute. Somebody called me yesterday and they're sending a bunch of different things from their sister's business and different things that, you know, the Abbey can use as gifts and stuff. And I was saying, thank you, and she said, no, thank you for letting me do this. It's, you know, it's so nice to be able to contribute to something that's worthwhile. So you see people's minds being very happy. Or the people who offer food. I remember, you know, Alice one time, and I think, Tracy, you've done this as well, you know, saying, oh, you know, we're so happy to give, and we feel so privileged to be able to be in this situation. So then there's real happiness and joy in the heart. And that's when people create so much good karma, you know, because the motivation's really good and the mind's really free. And you get pleasure now, and then you experience happiness later on. And then meanwhile, the rest of us are using up all of our good karma by receiving. And so, you know, that's why it becomes a great responsibility on the side of the people living at the Abbey to use the resources properly and to practice properly. You know, because if we don't, then we're just using up our good karma and not creating any good karma in return from the kindness and generosity other people are showing us. Okay, so that's why, you know, from the side of the people who give, there's delight. Then the side of the people who receive, there should be not just delight and, you know, oh, I got a stud finder, you know, my new toy, you know, I have a stud finder. But to take joy in, you know, giving the Dharma and, you know, giving the good vibes and, you know, and sharing with other people, not just joy in receiving, you know. Oh, good, we got some new drywall, you know. Okay, so I think that's okay. We did 1, 2, 3, 4 verses today. Okay. Any questions or comments?
Small question about this one about evicting people from their garden. We have a mole living in the garden. If we evict it to plant things, are we creating negative karma?
We're
right in the middle of the garden.
Yeah. He's living in the
vegetable garden.
He has a outlet here and there, and you know you can see the dug up in the tunnels.
Where he's living. Well, I don't really know. I mean, in one way, you kind of want to let somebody be. In another way, like with we were talking about the field mice and the carpets, they're field mice, and so they'll find another place in the field, you know? Mm-hmm. So if we evict the mole, then we should be very careful that we don't kill him,
yeah.
You know? Like not plug up all the holes. Do you even know how to evict a mole?
Not really.
Yeah.
Something,
yeah. And it, is it dangerous? Can you still plant the garden?
Well, you know what will happen is a lot of times they'll go and they'll eat all the rooting vegetables like the carrots. And things along the
side. Okay. Maybe we can just mentally kind of ask him to leave,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And indicate that there's some other places on the 240 acres he could live on. Yeah, and see if he feels okay with that. Because right now there's nothing in the garden for him to eat anyway.
Yeah.
He'd be much better off living somewhere else, wouldn't he?
Sure, sure.
Do you actually know that he's still there?
The horses, the tree, they weren't there like from the beginning that we got here.
Huh.
So they appeared, I would say, within the last week, I think.
I see. Huh.
Yeah.
So maybe we can ask him to, before he moves his furniture in.
Yeah. Maybe think about it somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Move, if he could just move over across the driveway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but definitely we don't want to hurt him. Yeah. But, you know, if we evict others, the mole or something like that, it should be for some good purpose, you know, not just because we don't want a mole there. Okay.
Well, things like that, and you're kind of rationalizing to some degree, I'm doing this for this other good.
Mm-hmm.
So is that just rationalizing then, or is that...
Well, you have to see if you're rationalizing or if you're actually transforming your motivation, you know? Mm-hmm. And thinking, well, you know, actually this isn't such a safe place for you to live, and it's not such a good place, and there's other places, and, you know, where the roots are better.
And the food grown here is going to nourish the sangha and the people who come to the island.
Yeah. And then realize, you know, make a prayer for him. You know, we have this karmic connection now. Mm-hmm. So by having this connection, you know, maybe could you make, like, maybe move yourself without us having to do anything, because we don't want to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And by the power of us having this karmic connection with you, then in future lives, you know, may you be born as a human being and have a precious human life and be attracted to the Dharma. And then by the force of our good practice, may we be able to teach you the Dharma in the future. Yeah. And so similarly with all any kinds of bugs or insects there are in the garden, or, you know, all the ticks that we find, or whatever, to recognize, okay, there's some kind of karmic connection, and make a prayer to be able to teach them the Dharma in their future lives.
Well, actually, when you garden and mow the lawn and things, you're really killing quite a few different movies.
Yeah.
So the whole time you're doing that, you should be sort of focusing on this.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think, you know, there's different philosophies about mowing the lawn, but maybe, you know, we don't have to always, you know, keep it as short as it can be, or mow it real often. We could, you know, if it has to be mowed, wait until the very end of the, you know, so that it cuts down on the number of times and it gets mowed and the number of beings who could get injured from it. Yeah. And then also, you know, like doing things in a season where there's not going to be so many living beings that get hurt. Yeah. So, yeah. And then just, you know, thanking the living beings for sharing this space with us, and, you know, explain that we're doing this for the purpose of practicing the Dharma. Because I'm thinking, you know, when we start building the meditation hall too, I mean, there it's gravel. There's not really so many plants, but there might be different living beings that are displaced, or, you know, yeah, like the mice or even little insects or whatever, you know, but to just, you know, that was part of the reason for the consecration, and kind of explaining to them, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, and, you know, we don't want to hurt anybody, and we're trying to practice well and share this space and peace with you, and so please, if you could, you know, move elsewhere, because we don't want to hurt anybody.